Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never that debt is fraud. And in our appeals to heaven, we need to continue to learn, pray, and act. I know this year we're fire hosing you with a lot of content. We've been going through, Tammy and I have been going through the main curriculum, i.e., you know, the Tory Acts, all of the principal documents that we typically cover every year. The new documents that I am covering, because I need to read these things, and while we read these things, we're really identifying, wow, they can't do that. And this has all been exposed, and I guess I could I could thank the state nationals for creating a menagerie of irrelevant documents, or I should say documents that don't actually provide them any gusto. But the one document out of this pile is amalgamation of these different documents that they put together where they think that they got a smoking gun. The only thing that is actually of very, very specific interest and shining a light on a real problem is the Enabling Act of Utah. And they don't even dive into the unconstitutionality. Folks, we're at a point where we're dealing with people that have invested a level of limited investigation. Instead of actually diving into source documents, they've actually been spoon-fed down a bread trail crumb of this is where you're going to find the information you need to build on all of this stuff. And they're finding these non-legal artifacts. The Federalist Papers are not a legal source document. They are non-legal artifacts. They're insightful. Reading Madison's journals, reading the letters between Hamilton and Madison are very insightful. And in so doing, reading those, this is how I actually discovered that the Federalist Papers are actually a poisonous seed. Now, I'm so blessed in working with great people. There's a new article out there. I'm going to put it out on my website. Well, actually, I'm going to provide you the link to it so to drive you to Loud and Liberty, because this is an article that is written by Sean Gerhardt. I believe I pronounced that correctly. But anyway, he provides some good insights. I've still got to write the academic, because giving everybody the details and dissecting it academically is essential. That's what I'm here for. So, but this right here is a great document that you can start going, oh, okay, wow. Moving forward, we need to get people to start putting aside their differences. You know, it's interesting, we're creating committees. We're actually formally We're formally creating committees. We hope to be forming, we hope in Wyoming to form legitimate legal committees and or councils and or conventions and or assemblies, whatever your county wants to call them. I believe that we shouldn't just label it as this is what it is. It is supposed to be representative of the people. It's just like, why don't we call, you know, the first state, the second state, to the 50th state, instead of calling it the state of Hawaii or the state of California or what have you, right? I mean, we should allow people to actually, you know, have control. It's called self-determination. What do you want to call yourself? What is your state flower? And hopefully that flower grows in your state. Sometimes people don't think, oh, I really love this, and come to find out it doesn't grow, or the bird doesn't really reside there, or, you know, naturally indigenous to. Anyway, moving outside the levity, we need to get organizations, because I've actually worked with a few people that have been, you know, creating supposedly committees of safety. And the reality is, when we look at what we're doing in these counties, legitimate provincial, they're not provincial governments. They're actually what these committees are in today's world under our Constitution. These are super juries. Now, we've kind of talked about this, and I've mentioned this before. When you look at the sacredness of the power of the people in being able to dissect and finalize exactly what the truth is, then we actually have the, you know, I'll just say it's the maxim. It becomes the standard. It becomes the bedrock. Because the jury, the people, have the final say. So these super juries that are going to be created in these counties have a very critical role. They need to learn and understand. And oh, by the way, as we go along through this process, every county has to actually challenge and verify the veracity of what these other counties have done. Because we may find that, you know, some counties may skip a step. That's right. I said that right. So we want to make sure that there is no question in anybody's mind that the only legitimate constitution is the organic, or what we call the original text of the original constitution, and the original text of all of the amendments that have been ratified, that we've got documentation have been ratified. So we need to bring back the 13th Amendment because we've got documentation. It was ratified. So we actually have 28 amendments, and I'm okay with all of them. There's no boogeymans in any of them. They knew that there was a boogeyman. By the way, the lawyers and the Bar Association knew there was a boogeyman in the 13th Amendment, which is why they had to go through this very maniacal and this very duplicit process of, I'll just say, expunging the 13th Amendment. Why? Because lawyers that are part of the Bar Association lose their citizenship based on the 13th Amendment. Well, we can't have that. And if we're going to have the Bar Association so that the legal system can start literally doing a transfer of wealth from the people into their self-aggrandized form of government. Folks, you hear me say this. We don't have a Republican form of government anymore. The Constitution still demands it. We're supposed to have it. And we still have these representatives. But when you have the judiciary having the final say, then that's a judiciary form of government. But in our Constitution, our representatives and we the people are representatives. See, the courts don't represent us. That's why the constitutions literally contain them to only making decisions on cases, on law and fact, no case law. So the Bar Association had to inject this case law and precedence. And actually, it was injected by the Supreme Court even before they created the Bar Association, because case law and precedence started to get used in 1830s. So it's amazing what you can do when you really start looking at the big picture and start going down these paths. The bottom line is we need to start getting organizations to actually back up and say, you know what, we all need to be working together. Why is it that none of these committees, none of these organizations that are trying to create these local groups are using First Amendment petitions and demanding full compliance and holding everybody accountable? We have everything we need in the Constitution. And instead, we're going to use affidavits. We're not going to actually use the constitutional process. We're going to use this process that the court system kind of gave us as what we'll call an artifact. The Constitution does not state that we have a right to petition via affidavit the court system. What kind of government do we have? If you're petitioning the court system, then you have a judicial form of government. If you have a representative form of government, those are the people that can redress your grievances. They can correct the law. They can hold people accountable. They can remove the judges. They can remove the executives. They can remove each other. because they are empowered by we the people. They've been given the sovereignty of the creation of law over all things delegated and over all things constitutional. I have to tell you, I said it yesterday, that Section 3 is clearly in the Constitution. It is the supreme law of the land. You even heard me say yesterday that Section 3 does not need any interpretation, does not need a law by the Congress or a law by your state legislature. Your county legislatures can read Section 3 and they can empower themselves in executing that. They don't need to, but if they want to, they can actually, you know, make a declaration that we are going to abide by the full Constitution. We're abiding by Section 3 of the 14th Amendment as the supreme law of the land. And anybody that violates their oath will be called out. And this means at this point in time, your county is the safest place in the union, because no corrupt person can exist anymore. What this means is everybody that's in office, everybody that is receiving money from the taxpayers, can be held accountable. And as a matter of fact, what they need to do is they need to set the standard that any employee in this county or any state employee, anybody that is employed by tax dollars, that means educators, school teachers, if your pay is coming from tax dollars, then you have to take an oath. And if you're involved in an insurgency, you're involved in any actions like supporting sanctuary cities, you are to be removed. You're to be banished because you're under oath, and this is how we hold people together. Folks, accountable. This is how we hold people accountable. I guess I'm maybe getting old where I don't have the good cognitive stringing the words together because I get excited. But at least I catch myself most all of the time when that didn't sound right. So let me fix that. Anyway, so when we start working with people, when you start working with people, we need to basically kind of have, I just want to say, an easy process. If an organization wants to maintain their myopic position, if an organization is not going to lead and join we the people in working on petitions and holding every public servant accountable with Section 3 of the 14th Amendment by using the right of petition for the redress of grievances to our legislators, then we need to basically either excoriate that organization, those people that are doing that, whoever's doing that, and call them out. It's almost like, you know, because it just comes to mind, you know, that one scene in The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and I'm talking about the really old one where Donald Sutherland was in it. And he was the guy that was, you know, kind of was aware of these body snatchers. And there was this, you know, this group of resistance. And out in public, you had to be very careful because the body snatchers kind of took over. And if they found out that you hadn't been snatched yet, then they would point and then they would basically grab you and convert you. And I don't really remember the movie, but I just remember the scene when at the end of the movie, when somebody saw Don Sutherland, one of the resistant people, I think it was a gal, she saw him and then she said, you know, started talking to him, you know, a little bit in a comfortable distance away, but she started talking to him, you know, hey, do you know about this? And all of a sudden he starts screeching like one of those creatures that have been, you know, taking over them, you know, pointing to her, and instantly she realized that, you know, she now is going to be, you know, seized and converted. I mean, her life as she knows it is done. And we need to do that. We need to actually, but we can't force them to come along. But we need to blackball them. We need to start identifying organizations that refuse to actually form or call for your counties to start getting constitutionally organized under the Constitution and common law, because they have the power to create these super juries, to create a symbiotic relationship between we the people and themselves as legislators for the county. They have the authority to do this. We can't go and create what everybody is doing in these, you know, jural assemblies, if they're creating these committees of safety, because they're all kind of the same. These groups that are going out either using affidavits or making appeals to the Hague, what they're doing is they're literally trying to create a shadow government. The jural assemblies are farther across that line of a shadow government than some of these committees of safety, because the committees of safety are, but they're equally unconstitutional, but they're just interfacing with the unconstitutional judiciary form of government. If we're going to use the Constitution and we're going to seek a redress of grievances, it is with our Republican. You can't fix a free market with regulations. Do you understand that? In other words, you can't create a mercantile economic system from a, you know, take a free market system into a mercantile economic system, which means that the government is controlling everything within the economic system. It's no longer free market. You can't use communist, or I should say socialist principles, or you can't use judiciary principles in a Republican form of government. We have to use the process of engaging our representatives to redress our grievances. They have the power. The sad thing is, everybody is teaching that no, those guys with the law degrees, they have the power. That is antithetical to the founding documents. We, the people, institute our governments. And somehow, along the way, the academic lawyers and judges stole our government. And basically, through the education system, we have all been convinced our government, you know, oh, it's a Republican form of government. Mechanisms that are controlling us. The party, the judiciary, the corporations and banks, right? Executives are creating bureaucracies, right? So we have a multitude of forms of government that have stolen our Republican form of government. So, as I'm finishing up the obligatories, because this is kind of a long introduction monologue, as I'm finishing up these things, we need to continually actually, if you don't do these things for yourself, then you're taking my word for it. And only a fool takes another man's word for something that is this critical and this important. Only a fool walks into a path of salvation based on somebody else's testimonies or somebody else's, you know, logical reasoning. When it comes to things of the Spirit, it needs to be between you and the Spirit and Him. When it comes to our government, it needs to not come from me, it needs to come from the source documents. This is why we've created a curriculum over the years in teaching and pointing to these source documents. The Tory Acts are legitimate source documents of our founded government, our empowered government, in the process of moving away from the British Empire. This was a provincial government creating the Articles of Association. This is why we cover this every year. And that it evolved into the Articles of Confederation. They had all sorts of problems, and then they said, we have to have a better way of having a general government serve us, but without controlling us and, you know, and doing what it's doing today, which created the Constitution. So, moving on, we have to get, because I'm trying to tie this all together, we have to get all of these organizations. Are you a part of the Eagles Forum? Are you a part of the 10th Amendment Center? Are you a part of, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. If it's the Center for Self-Governance, if it's the John Birch Society, it doesn't matter. If they're not endorsing your representatives at the county level to create by the auspices of common law and the Constitution, our constitutional rights of assembling and petitioning government for the redress of grievances. That's why those things are together. And your representatives have the ability to create that assemblage. This is why the First County and the Insights of Wes McCart actually called it the Constitutional Review Assembly instead of a committee, because it actually goes with the constitutional right of assembling. That's what they called it. The Jural Assemblies, I mean, I get that, but see, even by the name Jural Assembly means that they're focused on the judiciary. And anyway, so the point is this, is we actually have to start creating this list. I've been saying this for years, and I have not done this. I've not actually created the website or a page where we start identifying the problems in our own ranks. And I'm telling you, these organizations that want to cling to the Federalist Papers, want to cling to, you know, it's our way or the highway, then we need to put them on the highway. And we need to get them out of our counties and out of our states. Because they're, I've said this time and time again, the conservatives themselves, these good people that are trying to actually engage government, but they have been misled by either, you know, using their moral values instead of the academic arguments of whether they have the authority to do it, or whether they want to use these other processes that don't even mesh. We have to get rid of that. We have to unite on the Constitution, full compliance of the Constitution, and use the constitutional processes that will allow us to restore our local governments, our state governments, and our federal governments. That's why this is called Reclaiming the Republic. This is a process. We're not an organization. We teach you the principles of the Constitution and what we need to do to reclaim the Republic. So, I'm here to help, and I'm not from the government. Folks, my contact information on reclaimingtherepublic.org is up to date. And by all means, give me a call, leave a message, give me your email. I would rather you email me instead of calling me, because that way I can directly start having interchange with you. But give me your phone number so that we can talk. If I have to communicate strictly through email, then it really limits me. Now, it actually makes it easy for me to respond, kind of. But for me, I don't have time to start typing big, huge epistles and letters. What I'll end up doing is I'll send you my documents, my articles, and say, this is what you need to understand. So, with that all being said, let me move into this new content. Because what we got to go into is an act to regulate the deposits of the public money, 1836. Now, the backstory to this is, and I find this very interesting, because everybody looked at Hamilton's bank, and it was unconstitutional, because it was truly a bank creating products, getting people to buy bonds, and the scheme of making money via like a commercial bank. But it was going to be done by the government in a charter. Well, that died by basically Jefferson and Madison. And when we got attacked, Madison had to create a new charter for a national bank. That charter did not include what Hamilton included. That bank was not selling bonds. I've never seen anything that stated that, and that's one of the reasons why that bank didn't go bankrupt. It only created debt, and then the taxes, the revenue coming into the government, went to pay that debt, which is how we actually got out of debt. And actually, they got out of debt early based on how much money we had to loan, but we got out of debt early, and Andrew Jackson took the glory for that. When we come back, we're going to show you how we've been taught this great thing that Andrew Jackson did, and actually, it was maniacal. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, then. All righty, then. So, back to Andrew Jackson. So, our history books, you know, as a matter of fact, folks, if you want to find out who the real maniacal people have been in our history, they're the ones that are being put on pedestals in our education system today. Alexander Hamilton, definitely a man on the highest pedestal, because they even made a play making money in helping everybody look at Hamilton as almost a demigod. So, as we look at those other people, why is it that Andrew Jackson is always getting the credit for something Madison put in play? Well, they didn't tell you because he got rid of the National Bank. But let's go into what he did in this act in establishing a federal bank. Because that's exactly what he did. He didn't create a charter, per se. They didn't go off and just create a charter, you know, with some private institution or what have you. What they did was they actually formed the federal bank. At least that's how I see it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. So this is an act to regulate the deposits of the public money, 1836. I want to make sure that I do. I need to put the link to this so that everybody can go through this. Okay, so be it enacted. This is being done by Congress. Be it enacted and signed by Jackson. And then it was reinforced by the Martin Van Buren, the next dolt. Now, if you don't look at these men, you know, in the light of their evilness, and you look at them in the light of, oh, well, Martin Van Buren's the guy that created the Democratic Party. Huh, okay, so before he did that, what was Martin Van Buren's focus? What was his focus in the Senate? Because that's where he was. He was a senator, a New York senator. At least, you know, this is my memory recalling. And he was the guy that actually said, we're putting a gag rule on any petitions coming into the Senate. You give us a First Amendment petition regarding slavery, and we're not even going to open it. We're just going to throw it away. We will not deal. It was a gag order. In other words, they were not to talk about slavery in the Senate. And why was that? Okay, so slavery was allowed in the Constitution until 1808 as far as the importation of persons for slavery. That had to stop. And I believe that the position on, and I don't see any records, but I'll bet you anything that the importation of slaves kind of started up again. Because, and one way or the other, they were expanding the slave business. Why? Because what happened in 1820 with Monroe in allowing the Missouri Compromise to move forward to basically inflict slavery upon states, now we've got a demand on slaves. So you got to remember that in Article 1, Section 9, I have no evidence of this, but this is just me right now off the cuff using my deductive power and reasoning, that it only makes sense that they're now having to, because Congress did not have the requirement to shut it down. If you read that one line or that part of the Constitution where it literally, you know, breaks this down, and it's Article 1 and it's Section 9, and it says the migration or importation of such persons as the states now existing shall think proper to admit shall be prohibited by Congress prior to the year, shall not be prohibited by Congress prior to the year 1808. But a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation not exceeding $10 for each person. Now, when we look at is there anything else, commerce, vessels, bonds? Because I think there was another mention. It's in Article 5, because the Article 5 Amendment Protection Clause kind of exposes both parts. So they say, provided that no amendment which shall be made prior to the year 1808 shall in any manner affect the first and fourth clauses. So we want to go to the fourth clause. No capitation or direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. And so I believe that that's in reference to this one taxation on slaves. Now, I believe that when they actually said we have to expand slavery, it only went along because it says they shall not prohibit anything until that year. Does not mean that they have to prohibit it. It just says they cannot prohibit it. I have this hunch. I'm not sure. I have no documentation. But I'll bet you if anybody goes through the annals of Congress, and I believe at this point in time, in the 1920s moving forward, that's really more in the Congressional Globe records, but we would probably find that Congress probably had an act where they basically recalled the act of ending the importation of slaves. Why? Because there was a need for slaves. All states that were coming in under a certain latitude had to have slaves. You see my point? So I don't think and you would think that the progressives would really be, you know, pointing this out, but it would have nothing but Democrat blood, all the blood would be on the Democrats' hands on this, which is one of the reasons why it's probably just suppressed, because it's just not good press. It's just not good press. So, and there's plenty of documentation. And as a matter of fact, Bob Parks, he used to be with Fox News. Bob Parks actually created a really good timeline on, you know, the evils of the Democratic Party. But I digress. Martin Van Buren was not a good man. And Martin Van Buren wanted to endorse and make sure this Species Act was basically promoted and supported. So let me get into this, because be it enacted that it shall be the duty of the Secretary of the Treasury to select as soon as may be practicable, and employ as the depositories of the money of the United States such of the banks incorporated by the several states, by Congress for the District of Columbia, or by the legislative councils of the respective territories for those territories as may be located at adjacent or convenient to the points or places at which the revenues may be collected or dispersed, and those states, territories, or districts in which there are no banks and within the public collection or disbursements require a depository, the said Secretary of the Treasury may make arrangements with a bank or banks in some other state, territory, or districts to establish an agency or agencies in the states, territories, or districts so destitute of banks as banks of deposit, and receive those such agencies, such deposits of the public money as may lie directed, be made at the points designated, and to make such disbursements as the public service may require at those points. Now, that's a semicolon. Now, that's, they love these long run-on sentences. And so, you know, people look at me and go, oh. And actually, there was a couple semicolons and commas and so forth, but at this point, I want to stop. What are they doing here? Are they basically setting up, because remember, they paid off the debt based on these taxes and revenues. And guess what? Those taxes and revenues needed to be repealed once the debt was paid off. But did anybody give credit to Andrew Jackson to, you know, stopping the repealing of those taxes? No. Interesting. So in other words, you know, it's kind of like when you build a bridge and you put a toll on it, right? And once you've paid for that bridge, they seem to keep that toll booth there, and they seem to keep on collecting. As a matter of fact, there was a good meme in social media regarding the Golden Gate Bridge. And they talk about how many cars cross the Golden Gate Bridge, because every car has to pay a certain amount, and this flat amount is, you know, like, it's, they break it down that each car pays this, there's this many cars a day, which if you total it up, you know, for how many cars a month, it's this much money, and it gets into the billions of dollars by the end of the year. In other words, that bridge and that bridge system is making billions of dollars. They paid for that bridge. They could have created another bridge with all the profits that they've been doing. So what are they doing with that? Oh, well, that's a tax they created, and now it goes into the coffers to be used for general purposes. In other words, now government is literally taking money and using it however they decide. Governments are to be limited to the powers delegated. They can only spend money on those things. And they've created these ambiguous contracts or what have you when they, oh, well, we'll repeal that, but they never do. It needs to be in writing that the when the last penny has been made, that next car will not pay. Therefore, you created a system that paid for this new lane and new process. You want to build another one? Then basically do the funding and have it paid off in the same manner. So you can have two bridges now instead of just one, and milking the people and forcing them to live with congestion that government, as long as government compresses you and as long as they make your life, you know, a reasonable hell, then, excuse the expression, a reasonable hell, then, you know, you will basically go along. Okay, I have to spend 2 hours commuting. Bottom line, our government should actually, because they have the control of our productivity, they should be doing everything they can to make it so you have the ability at a very low cost, if no cost, for you to get to work instantly. The faster you get to work, the more productive you become, and productivity is best for society. Oh, but we realize that we're making bank off of this, and so, you know, we can put more of a burden and make them work harder. That's exactly what government's been doing, making us work harder. But in this particular first part that I've read, this is clearly laying out a structure of a federal banking system directly tied to state, territory, district banks. Private banks that they're going to basically federalize. And what are they going to do? Well, I can tell you right now, they're going to take this money and they're going to deposit millions of dollars. Why do they have millions of dollars? This is millions of dollars that it should be paying for the necessities, but they didn't stop the taxes. They had all this money coming in. And so big government now is going to start expanding the love, because they felt that the way to do this was to pump money out to the states and the territories. It may be a good idea for expanding productivity and so forth, but it's unconstitutional. They don't have the power to do that, and government is supposed to be limited to those things necessary, those things delegated, not allowed to do things not delegated. So let me continue on. And to receive through such agencies such deposits of the public money as may lie direct at the points designated, and to make such disbursements as the public service may require at those points. The duties and liabilities of every bank, thus establishing any such agency, to be the same in respect to its agency as are the duties and liabilities of banks generally under the provision of this act, provided that at least one such bank shall be selected in each state and territory, if any can be found in each state and territory, willing to be employed as depositories of the public money. In other words, being federalized to basically create this holding of public money upon the terms and conditions hereinafter prescribed and continue to conform thereto, and that the Secretary of the Treasury shall not suffer to remain in any deposit bank an amount of the public money more than equal to 3/4 of the amount of its capital. In other words, they're creating this deposit that will not account to more than 3/4 of the capital. So in other words, it's like holdings. And they want to make sure that the federal government is creating a massive holding for the bank, 3/4 of the capital, no more than 3/4 of the capital, so going up to 3/4, to allow the bank to be able to administer loans and so forth, as long as they're maintaining 3/4 of the federal dollars in their bank safe. Okay? All right, so let me see here. With more than 3/4 of the amount of its capital actually paid in for longer time than may be necessary to enable him to make the transfers required by the 12th section of this act, and that the banks so selected shall be, in his opinion, safe depositories of the public money, and shall be willing to undertake and do and perform the several duties and services and to conform to the several conditions prescribed by Section 4, and be it further enacted that the said banks, before they shall be employed as the depositories of the public money, shall agree to receive the same upon the following terms and conditions, to wit. Now they're going to break down all seven sections. And they're going to basically say, this is what you got to do here, this is what you got to do here. And so each of the sections, these are the regulations of what you have to do to basically receive this money. Now, I don't think, I'm going to just kind of scan over this, because I don't think they actually talk about the money. And when we look at Van Buren and his support of all of this, I think this is where we actually get a good view of how much money they were talking about. And so when we look at the amount of money, I think it was something like either $30 or $50 million. $30 or $50 million. Now, I'm here to tell you that that was only a good portion of the public money. There's no doubt in my mind the federal government, they were creating this reserve system, a banking system, unconstitutionally. There's no doubt in my mind Andrew Jackson made sure that the other taxes, or the revenues from these excessive taxes, were being used to help bolster the federal government, to help strengthen them in the process of making them, converting them from the grandchild or the great-grandchild in our government hierarchy to becoming the parents of all. The owners of all and the parents of all. All of this, folks, as the state nationals make, you know, constantly pound their chest that, you know, we've got a government, you know, under this Constitution that is literally and legitimately tyrannical and destroying us. I have yet to see any state national actually, you know, have a position of all of these things being unconstitutional. They base their whole argument on the premise that this is a legitimate government. which means that's why they do not have a flow chart, or they do not have a way of how we get back into the constitutional framework. They believe that the framework is by itself corrupt. And they're wrong. They are wrong. The people are corrupt. And it's just like the churches. Folks, the people are the problem. We are the problem. As a matter of fact, I don't think I was it wasn't a wise saying, but I remember I started helping people understand, because they go, well, why do you want to move someplace where, you're so remote? There's not a lot of people. Because people are the problem. It's literally this way. The greatest things on the earth, period, are the people. Because we are the creation of Him in His image. And we can do amazing things in His name. However, when we look at those people who choose not to do that, the most despicable, you can look at the, viruses and killer, bacterias and, these vile things in the world. But the most vile thing in the world are the people. Those people who choose to be that vile. Those people who choose to serve Him are the greatest things, right? Do you see my point? We are the complete spectrum of everything that is good about this world we live in and the worst things about this world we live in. So, when we actually start looking at the government itself and what was created to create a government of accountability, you can't tell me that this Constitution and the framework, including the 14th Amendment, actually galvanized, that 14th Amendment galvanized the beauty of this Constitution. It finished the makeup of the necessary body of true government in the hands of the people. In other words, in the hands of the people, but not a democracy. We must hold them accountable. And when we start getting engaged at the party level, businesses and so forth, to start, increasing government to basically ingratiate us and serve us, we and our corruption allows these things to happen. This is why we have to start creating, the blacklist. We have to start creating, the dirty list. Those people who claim to be good guys, white hats, it's the black hat list. Because the true black hats are those who are in our midst among us. Because we do not see their black hat. We know that the communists are red hats. They're bad. They're our enemy. But our greatest enemy are the black hats. Those are the guys that are living and sneaking around and actually in our midst, misleading us and misguiding us and controlled opposition. We get rid of them and we start uniting on these fundamental principles of the Constitution. We get our government back. It's that simple. So, Section 1, I got 5 minutes, less than 5 minutes. First, each bank shall furnish the Secretary of Treasury from time to time, as often as he may require, not exceeding once a week, statements setting forth its condition and business, and that the said banks shall furnish the Secretary of the Treasury and to the Treasurer of the United States a weekly statement of the condition of his account upon the books. And the Secretary of the Treasury shall have the right by him or an agent appointed for that purpose to inspect such general accounts in the books of the bank and shall regulate the statements, provided that this shall not be construed to imply a right of inspection the account of any private individual or individual Smith the bank. And I don't understand this individual Smith the bank, but that's what it says. Okay, Section 2. Secondly, to credit as specie all sums deposited therein to the credit of the treasurer, in other words, to make sure that the specie that they have and I'm going to guess that it's going to be a certain amount, but it says, to credit as species all sums deposited, that means everything, but I thought that they said three-fourths, to the credit of the treasurer of the United States, and to pay all checks, warrants, or drafts drawn on such deposited in species if required by the holder thereof. Thirdly, to give whenever required by the Secretary of the Treasury the necessary facilities for transferring the public funds from place to place within the United States and the territories thereof, and for the distributing the same in payment of the public creditors without charging commissions or claiming allowance. In other words, you can't make money. We're going to make money, but you can't on the difference of exchange. Fourthly, to render the government of the United States all the duties and services heretofore required by law to be performed by the late bank, remember the bank, the charter that died? Okay, that was performed. So in other words, to render the government of the United States and the duties and services heretofore required by law to be performed by the late Bank of the United States and its several branches or offices. So in other words, he didn't actually get rid of the old charter and the bank. He just, instead of renewing the charter, he did this act. You see what he did? Oh, but he... It always goes down to, you know, evil always wants to take credit for what they want you to believe is a good thing. Okay, so section four. Fourthly, to render the government of the United States all duty services. Oh, okay, so that I just read that. Section five, and be it further enacted that no bank shall be selected or continued as a place of deposit of the public money, which shall not redeem its notes and bills on demand in specie. Section 6. And it be further enacted that the money which shall be in the Treasury of the United States on January 1st, 1837, this is when Andrew Jackson is still in office, reserving the sum of $5 million shall be deposited with such of the several states in proportion to their respective representation in the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States. Now, I'm going to stop right there. I want to see if I have the statehood order. Okay, so I've got the statehood order in front of me. And I am going to go through to 1837. January 26, Michigan joined, so they don't count. And so at this point, they had, because it was going to be $5 million per state and or territory, right? This is 25 states. So if they may have claimed and said that they're going to play with $50 million, if you add 5, or take 5 times 25, that's a lot more than $50 million. That's well over $100 million, folks. So when we actually, you know, dive into this concept of what he's doing, they're actually distributing a mass amount of money. Now, before I get back into this tomorrow or on Monday, you know, it just seems to me that now that they did this, that it actually makes a good insight of why there's so many movies about people stealing money that was being transferred back and forth, because they were creating this system. Anyway, we'll dive more into this on Monday. I'm Jerry Mobley with Reclaim the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract. And with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.